This is like my fangirl, fan person moment of recording this podcast, actually.
I know.
Offense, because like all everybody else,
everybody,
they're amazing. Yes, I mean, we've had some amazing guests. But
really, they're all duds compared to you, Catherine. No, we're just so lucky to have you on the podcast. Catherine Nicolai is the author of Nothing Much Happens, and I'm like such a huge fan. I can't believe you're here.
We have so many nights of restful sleep that we can thank Catherine for.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm so glad to help.
So we'll give you a little intro, and then we'd just love to just launch in and become best friends with you.
Sounds good.
So Catherine Nicolai is the creator of the enormously successful podcast Nothing Much Happens and the author of the book of the same name. Nicolai is an architect of coziness. It's so true. Writing soothing stories that both ease the reader into peaceful sleep and teach the principles of mindfulness so that waking hours likewise become sweet and serene. She leans on her years of experience as a yoga and meditation teacher to seamlessly blend storytelling with brain training techniques that build better sleep habits over time. She lives in Michigan with her wife and three dogs.
Yay! And the three dogs. And welcome, Catherine. Thank you so much for being here.
It is so my pleasure. I'm so excited to be with y'all.
We told Catherine before we hit record that she has, I mean, first of all, we don't have a Bob Wittersheim. I wish we did. I wish
needs one.
I wish we could just poach Bob Wittersheim, but we wouldn't dare because Nothing Much Happens is just such an incredible. I was thinking about this. Mary has a lot more trouble sleeping than I do, but we both have bipolar disorder and sleeping can be a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and Nothing Much Happens is just such a, I know a lot of people who just listen to it in just their waking hours. I'm sure that you hear people who say the same.
Yeah.
So you just do such a service in the world. Mm-hmm. And we're just so glad you're here.
It is so absolutely my pleasure, you know, because I had this little dream, this little idea years ago, and to see what it offers to people and the comfort it can bring to people, it is absolutely my pleasure. I think when you get to work in an art form that brings active relief to people's pain, there is no better feeling than that. You know, I feel so lucky to be able to do it. And so grateful to be able to be there for people, whether it's just a bad night's sleep or, you know, they're going through some recovery or working through trauma or just living in the world today. If I can be like a soft landing for them, I feel so, so grateful for it.
And you've been in a lot of different healing roles in your life.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like you've, from all angles, you're just like, you are a healer. I think you and Mary are alike in that way. It's like you are here to heal people.
Right.
Yeah.
The performance aspect is really secondary to the work, to the healing work. And you taught yoga before, right? Or do you still teach yoga?
I don't right now. I sold my studio a few months ago to do this full time.
Wow.
And I wonder if it's this way for you too, Mary. People often because when I was a yoga teacher or in all these different facets, they would say, you know, does it make you nervous? Do you get anxious? Do you ever feel insecure? And I often found that if I was stepping into the place of I'm going to help somebody, I never felt that way.
Mm.
And that is what actually facilitated me being able to do things like write, even when I'd always been afraid to try, or speak, even when I wasn't sure if I was the best person equipped, because I had this bigger goal in mind of, but I might help somebody. And what if I don't do it? And I think it's just, I got to go for it. And it relieved that pressure of it having to be perfect. I always say like as I came through my 30s, I had this wonderful moment of like a reckoning of my own mediocrity and going, oh, I'm not perfect at everything. And I'm not even great at a lot of things, but that doesn't really matter. And it shouldn't necessarily stop me creating or trying.
So true.
There really is such a, well, we could save this for after our lives also, but there really is like, I think this mindset around attempting things, like if you aren't excellent at them, if you don't mm-hmm. excel, if you're not a master or a prodigy right away, that you have no business doing yeah. it. And we hear so many stories about people who just like, right, they knew what they wanted to do when they were 12 years old, or like since they, you know, like they just came out of the womb knowing they were going to be a professional soccer player or whatever. And
yeah,
or, you know, like I think about people who don't sort of blossom or realize their path until later in life. And we just don't hear very many stories like that, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think a reckoning with one's mediocrity is a good, like that's a good threshold experience. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. It really is. And I think it's one of those gifts that comes with aging, you know, where I used to always joke about how when I was in like middle school band, how there were, how I played seventh chair flute, but there were only four of us. you know, they're like, move down. And because I couldn't be the best, I quit. Mm-hmm. And that was my approach to so many things when I was younger. I didn't have that maturity, you know, to go, well, but what might I find like just playing? You know, I thought I had to win everything. And even that was my approach when I first became a yoga teacher, because I had a genetic set of combinations that made me ridiculously mobile in my joints, which sometimes was not a great thing at all as a yoga teacher, because I didn't understand how a lot of bodies felt and moved. I only understand like sort of an extreme on the scale, but because in my immaturity, I thought, well, that must be what's important. It brought me into great things, but at first it was just a catch of the ego where I really missed some sweet experiences.
Right. Wow, that's so real. Yeah. Being involved with things just for like the joy of being involved yeah. in it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Just
yeah,
pure.
Yeah. Just like the reward is in the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
That sounds really trite, but I mean, it's really true. Like I learned a lot by being on my high school bowling team and being unbelievably bad at it. But yeah. I had such hubris that I was like, I'm going to be good at this. So I bought like a custom ball and my own shoes. And I was like, anybody who doesn't have their own ball is such a loser. And yet I sucked. Then I realized it was all for me just about aesthetic, not about actually doing anything.
This is perfect. This is also like bowling is like a great like framework for we're about to lay some pins down with these stupid little lies.
Wow, what a segue.
Well done.
Oh well my done, gosh. You know, I'm impressed. I'm impressed, honey. You're really upping your game because we have a high quality guest. It's really,
I know
you are rising to the occasion and I really, okay. Go. You want to go first, honey?
Yep.
Okay. Go.
Llama llama ding dong. M, is fulfilling their lifelong dream and moving to a llama farm and becoming a llama whisperer. Oh, sorry. That was a Dalai Lama. No. I hope there's no drama with the llamas. It is a llama. It's not the Dalai Lama.
That was really convoluted.
And I'm at every moment.
I'm like, you're blowing my mind. The segue, the plot twist. Honey, can you bring it down a little bit? You're making me feel bad. Okay. These are two of the weirder ones I've ever written. Ice skating is so passe. Lacing up the skates and gracefully gliding over the frozen surface of a lake, super lame.
Yeah.
That's why Tamara Y has invented chainsaw skating, in which you crudely affix jagged chainsaw blades onto your skates. And yes, they're motorized. A triple axle? How about a triple hacksle of destruction tearing up the whole lake? That's it. Sorry, that was kind of anticlimactic.
That's so dangerous. Wow.
I eat danger for a midday snack. God bless.
Catherine, would you like to read a lie?
Please.
Sure. And I can't read it because I just wrote it a second ago in my head when you told me the name of the person I'm lying about. Okay. But, you know, I'm kind of used to just telling a story. And
I was going to say, thank goodness you have some experience in this area.
Yes. Well, you know, I see a story in everything. So Hannah, I don't know if you guys know Hannah. Well, she's been in the Town Tattler a couple times for stealing flowers. And but also, if you've ever like opened your mailbox and that's not the magazine you subscribe to, but oddly it fits, Hannah's the one switching the magazines in all the mailboxes. She doesn't think that you need to get real. You don't read your Dwell. But your neighbor up the street might actually read it. She just put people in there because she knows you and she wants you to be honest with yourself.
Hannah, that little scamp. I knew Hannah knows you. That's where that issue of Real Simple came from.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what?
But you read it.
In the back for baked ziti that I'm actually going to use.
You will. So the you got to trust Hannah.
You know, the flower theft is, frankly, not aligned with my personal values, but I'll allow it. Okay. It all balances out. All right. So it was actually Elmo's birthday on Thursday. Did y'all know that?
Oh,
I hope that y'all had a chance to celebrate with an episode or two of Sesame Street. Or maybe you took the opportunity to hug your very own Tickle Me Elmo doll if there are still batteries in that thing. Well, it's a well-kept secret that Elmo is a famous tax evader and a draft dodger. He feigned a leg injury to avoid serving in the Vietnam War and owes millions to the IRS. Daniel L. exposed this and more in his new book, Elmo Learned That Was Not Okay. That's the shortened title. The full title is, Elmo thought it was okay not to pay taxes for years and years and flout Elmo's obligation to his country, but Elmo learned that was not okay. Also, don't come after us for copyright infringement because that was a parody. I'm protected under parody law. Did you like it?
Wow.
Thank you.
You know, and the long subtitle is often encouraged. If you get the really long subtitle, they like that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, in academia, we always have to be like, this thing, colon, this thing, yes. And this thing in the context of that other thing. And I'm very smart. .edu.
Yes. Well, I don't know if y'all saw the Olympics opening ceremony, but Cassie P was there and she was involved in the
Olympics?
In the Golden Nugget dance competition and delivered the snowflake flame. And of course, as you know, she's competing in the Olympic ring toss and the huge spaghetti cook-off event. You know, for centuries they've had.
Oh, honey, you're hallucinating a whole Olympic Games. And I just really, I wish I could just live inside that brain for just a minute. If there's not an Olympic ring toss, I feel like that's a real crossover event that they're not taking advantage of.
Yeah. My wife and I used to always want to see if we could get like synchronized walking going. we would watch the synchronized swimming and be like, yeah, that's not going to happen. But what if we like could and we'd practice in the neighborhood. And
I was just going to ask
the hell out of that.
I would watch the hell out of just y'all's practice sessions.
Like, I guess that's dancing.
No, but you're walking, so there's movement involved.
It's we would still wear the nose clips just for the effect. Right. And the caps. It's very serious.
The more earnest, the better in any kind of a situation like that. Curling has always been on the list of things, you know, I just love to do. Is curling like... Is that a regional thing? As a Michigander, are there like curling competitions in your hometown?
There probably are in the UP in the Upper Peninsula, but I feel like just being Midwesterner, I've seen lots of curling. If you go into a bar at a certain time of day, there's curling on.
Oh, they're watching it. I was like,
we're all watching curling. Not till like 2 or 3 in the morning, but yes.
I am just so inspired by that. Anything that is that silly that you have to like really wonder like the levels of human boredom that had to be achieved before they were like, let's find like this 30-pound thing and broom.
And the explaining, yeah. Right? Where you're like, well, the whole point, okay, hold on. You're going to need a broom. It's going to be really cold. Yeah. It's like bocce, but you know, it's not sunny. There's no wine.
And you're
it's
sliding on your knees for a lot of it. Does that sound okay?
It's going to hurt.
Yeah, it's going to hurt.
Wyatt was the first person to show me that is it Olympic speed walking?
Yes.
Like yes, speed I watched that last time too. I was obsessed with that.
Like, and that's okay with everybody?
And then they get the flag if they're sort of starting to run. There's people who walk by them. It's like, hey, hey, hey.
That's policing excellence, and I would have overachieving. Actually, you know, it's like forcing you stay in your lane.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think you're doing hot dogging in this walking
yes.
distance? If you want to run, you can go to the freaking marathon, buddy.
That's a different game.
That was my punitive walk policing voice. But so you are in your office right now. I'm trying not to freak out about this. Mary knows. I don't get starstruck very often. Mm-hmm. I'm starstruck by, of course, just Catherine Nicolai being here. But also, shucks. Portia is in the room. Portia is one of your three dogs.
Yes.
And they are all just absolutely wonderful. And anytime there's a dog in one of the stories on Nothing Much Happens, I just assume that it's Portia. Like, that's just always where my brain goes. I'm always on Instagram, like, commenting, like, Portia, I'm obsessed. Portia, notice me.
Do you want me to get her?
Oh my God.
Yeah, of course. Come here, Porsche.
Honestly,
come here, Bunny.
It's got like kind of red. Like, my head
Oh, Porsche.
Oh, okay. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you get to see this video.
This would make you subscribe right here because this is just, right? This is something you need to see.
Face.
I got like a really big belly.
Thank you, Porsche. Yes, the belly. Oh, my God. And you told us that you mentioned turnip, and you said that you had that you're a lover of beagles, that you had a beagle for a long time.
Yeah, I did. I had Lois was sort of my first dog that I adopted in like right out of college, and she lived to be 17, she plays a big part in me finding my way into Nothing Much Happens. She was always a little bit of a tricky dog, and it kind of gives you compassion because you realize that not all things can be fixed. Mm. And some people are just going to have issues their whole life, and you have to figure out how to compassionately live with them in your family. And that was Lois. Lois was, we used to always say Lois didn't like nice things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got Lois a brand new bed, fuck that. You know, she feed her something nice. Ugh, you know, she just she had her own like way of being that was not what you would think for most dogs. But I loved her dearly. And in her later years, she would pace all night long because she had sort of that sundowner situation. Mm-hmm. So one night I was just sitting with her on the floor in the living room. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was trying to get her to settle down. And I had for years had this idea about the bedtime stories. And I had always wanted it to be a book, but I just thought, how do I get from like where I am now, a lay person with no connections to the publishing industry? It feels so impossible, right?
Right.
So I kind of put that on the shelf, and then I'm laying there like with Lois, and I was like, oh, it's a podcast. Oh, it's a podcast.
Yes.
And like sitting on the floor, I'm like scrolling through my phone. I bought a microphone. I texted Bob Wittersheim because he was a friend and I knew that he could help at like, he probably didn't appreciate it, 3 o'clock in the morning. And,
he's
and
like,
we,
no, I
we launched in
story.
Like 6 weeks. Yeah, exactly. And we launched like 6 weeks later. So Lois
my goodness.
There.
So is it, I'm trying to kind of decide. I feel like we were like sort of early adopters of the podcast. How long have you been doing it now? Is it 3 years, more than 3 years?
It'll be 4 in April. So it was 2018.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did, I wonder, I just imagine that the demand for comforting things really skyrocketed during the pandemic. Did you notice a like sort of an uptick in people listening or sort of more people engaging with it?
For sure. Our listenership doubled during the pandemic. And you could even kind of track it with surges. You know, when things would go down a little bit and people would sort of have this moment of feeling like things were more normal, they maybe relied on it less and then they would come back to it. So,
right.
Yeah. So I feel like it was, I don't think that there's ever going to, you know, ever be a time in human history where people aren't going to have a buffet of things to worry about. That's just sort of being alive in the world.
Right.
But I'm really glad that it was like established and ready for that moment.
Right. No kidding. And even though as you mentioned, the publishing industry is such a, like a tough thing to break into, you like not only got your stories published ultimately, but you like published through Penguin in this beautiful, I mean, this like just gorgeously. I just love the way that this book is illustrated. And it's Leah Lequiver. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah. Leah's fantastic. It was such a dream for me to have it illustrated. I have a condition called aphantasia, which means I cannot visualize anything. So I have no inner eye, or if I do, I can't see the screen. Like it could be that images are generated in my brain, but I can't access them. And so, you know, I really had no idea what the village looked like. And so like to be able to chat with Leah and give her the manuscript and kind of talk her through that process, when she would look to me for certain guidance, I'd be like, this is why you're here and so important. Because I don't know.
Yes. No, and I bet you have also heard, like, I personally freaked out a little bit when Jenna Fisher, aka Pam from The Office, posted that she was a fan. I'm sure that you've gotten like some other people who you're like, holy crap, you're a fan of my podcast.
Yeah, those moments blow me away. And my wife is always, she's very grounding to me. So she never really freaks out that much. But there were a couple times when I was like, you're going to need to freak out when I tell you this. One of the ones that really just blew my mind was, do y'all watch the British Bake Off?
Ooh, yes, we do. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if you saw the season when Nadia won.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes.
I love her so much. And she had this wonderful speech at the end about how she was never going to say she couldn't do something. Yes! And it's just this pure moment of like pride in herself and pride in how much she how far she'd come. And I used to show it at the end of like yoga teacher training. And it was like so inspirational to me. And so one night she posted about my book that it was her next read. Like I can see it there in her hand.
Oh, and I'm like, my God, yes.
Waking up my wife, you know, I'm like trying to get her to understand what's happening. I'm like, okay, we'll revisit it in the morning, but it's a big deal.
Yes, that's right. You're like, this is happening. I need you to be conscious right now. Yeah. Wake up. I can get you back to sleep. Just wake up now.
Yes.
Too, where like, I feel like there are like really famous, people that you know, that interacting with, like singing with Madonna is like the thing. But I lost my fucking mind when I met Gracie Gold. She's like one of my favorite figure skaters. Mm-hmm. And like,
oh yeah.
I was verklempt. I was like, I couldn't get words out. And I was like, oh, I get it now. Like, I feel like I finally understand the fan.
Yes. Thing,
you know, where I was like, I'm like, does she think I'm stupid?
Like when I met the Chicago Bulls mascot and I like lost my mind. I was like, how is this happening? Oh my gosh.
What's next on the horizon for you? Are you just kind of, do you like where you're at and just kind of keeping that routine?
I've got a lot of stuff coming up. I'm really excited. I just finished the second book. It's a really beautiful like expansion of the village. And I had this idea of, you know, that experience when you're walking down a street and you're looking at all the houses and you're wondering who lives in all those houses.
Yes.
So I wrote sort of a book based on a street in the village, and we go from one house to the next and we kind of see who lives in that house, like what makes their life interesting, and then how do they connect to the other people in their community? Because that's a theme that is really important to me, is that even if you don't feel always connected or supported, there is a web there. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people meaning to do well all around the world. It's just a really, it's not meant to be bedtime reading. I mean, like not to make you fall asleep, but it's what I call conflict free. The idea is that it's not something that's going to agitate you or, you know, lean into your negativity bias. It's going to be something that soothes and inspires you. So that is just finished, and hopefully we'll know more about when that will come out soon. And then I've got even bigger plans. I'll tell you guys off mic, but I can't share them yet. But just that there's lots of ways that you could experience the world of Nothing Much, and I want to keep bringing people all different ways to do it. And I got more books. I got a lot of ideas. I felt like, you know, for years I didn't think I had any creativity at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was a creative person. And I think this is common for a lot of people who maybe fall into that thing we were talking about earlier, where you feel like if I'm not automatically the best at it, or I don't have like this calling from childhood about it, like you can't connect to it. But I always thought like I was art adjacent, like all my friends were artists and musicians, and I was in theater coming up, and I was in theater in school, and, you know, everything was about art, but I always felt like I didn't have that thing. And I was honestly jealous in a way that I've never really been jealous, you know, in my life about other things. And so I didn't think I had any creativity at all. And again, part of that like awakening in my mid-30s was like, eh, what the hell? I'll just try.
Right. That's so cool. And you're so, I was
going to say, writing.
Hearing that you experience the aphantasia is so mind-boggling to me, because you are so, I don't know why, I just sort of intuitively wouldn't guess that based on how good you are at conjuring worlds and how, I mean, yeah, I feel like
it's so illustrative, like how,
yeah, I mean, I feel like when I think of one of your stories, like when I think about the rainy day making soup, I can see the kitchen, and I can imagine, you know, where the ingredients are and what the sort of air smells like in the room. And maybe that's kind of my brain filling in the spaces, you know, yeah. But it's interesting to me that you are so good at world building. Are you, has writing stories always been a part of your life?
Not really. I mean, it was something that I always wanted to do. And I think I did when I was like too young to be aware of being self-conscious about such things. And then sort of coming into my preteen years, I stopped. I mean, I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote things like that. And then I wrote essays in college and stuff. And I could always feel myself like trying to dip the toe into creative writing. But my brother's a really amazing writer and poet. And I think I felt like, that's, you know, Greg does that. And I'll leave that to him. And I don't think, because again, I couldn't compete. So I couldn't be first chair. So I I put my flute away. So
yeah, right.
Yeah. So I really started writing when I started conceptualizing the podcast. And some of those stories were stories I had told myself to fall asleep, because this is something I've done my entire life. It's one of my earliest memories, being like 4 years old and telling myself a story to fall back asleep. And so I always felt like I know how to do this. Like I had a superpower. Right. And then people would tell me, my yoga students and family and friends, about their anxiety and their insomnia. And I kept thinking, like, how do I get this from me to you? Like, right. I know how to do this. So that's why the podcast was so perfect, because after years as a yoga teacher too, I think you learn so much about like how to build a mood, how to create a space with your voice and your presence and your words so that people feel safe and receptive. And so really podcast was perfect, because then I could reach out with my voice.
And you're so visionary too, to, you know, you mentioned when we were about to start recording, and we've said that our podcast was a shit show, and you said that yours is so structured, but you really like, you were, I think that's such an innovative structure. The fact that you do have the sort of like predictability and the sameness of sort of the opening and the breathing exercise and the overview of the story and the sort of like instructions. And there's just something so soothing about that. And like you said, like, not enough, no conflicts, like nothing going on so that it's like enough to really stimulate you. But I think having not only kind of started a podcast out of thin air, but also not like, there aren't really any models that are like this.
Right.
It's just, I think it's just so, so brilliant of you. And you've maintained, like, I mean, it seems to me like it's the same structure since the very beginning, right?
Yeah. There's very few changes, and it was all just instinctual. Like I was like, I have to tell the story twice. It just was an instinct feeling of, if people know they're going to hear it again, it gives them permission to let go, because it's going to come around. But also, you know, look at how many things we do repetitively for comfort. People watch the same TV show over and over again. And even just having like those rituals in your day where you lean into their regularity to feel sort of safe and in your groove. So that, and also, you know, yoga is the same way. My classes would have like a rhythm to them, where we're going to get started in this way, that you're going to experience these ups and downs, and then we're going to end this way. So I feel like I was really set up for that. And I even feel like my aphantasia sets me up a little bit for that, because I feel like I'm somebody who, so I have aphantasia in all my senses. It's usually people, when people talk about it, they mostly mean that they can't visualize, but I can't like imagine anything through any of my senses. Like some people can remember the way something sounded. They can hear a voice in their head. I don't have like an inner monologue. Mm. Or they can remember the way something felt or the way something smelled. And I don't have anything like that. So I feel like I'm very present.
Yeah, you're in the moment.
I have this moment, and it has made me like so aware of the facets of this moment. So I can explain them in great depth. I'm fascinated by them. So I really think of it as such a gift, you know, that my brain is just the way that it is.
Right. It's got that sort of that like still life, like every detail is important and vibrant. And I love the part of your instructions where you sort of say like, if later you need to, you can call on a detail that I mentioned. You
yeah.
can meditate on that detail. And there's something too, I think about like just focusing on just, I feel like the type of media that we consume is just the absolute opposite of that. I mean, I'm yes. so accustomed to like, I like when somebody sends me a video to watch and it's longer than like 2 minutes. I'm like, are you out of your mind? I'm not going to, yes.
like leaving a voicemail. What's wrong with you?
Or, email. Like, have you seen that? There's like an internet meme where it's like a screenshot of a text and the person's like, wow, I'm so happy for you. Or I'm sorry that happened. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't read it.
appropriate response. Right. Hear. That's so funny, Mary, because my outgoing message on my voicemail is me going, in a world where nobody answers their phone, you've reached the one woman who will call you back. Maybe. I guess. I don't know why you're not texting me. Why don't you just text me?
Like, this better be good. Go ahead.
What is wrong with you? Is someone dead? If someone leaves me a voice message, I assume so.
Oh, 100%. Like when, it's like when my sister calls me and I'm like, either somebody died or yes. she just wants to say hi and there's yes. no in between.
Yep, those are the two options. Yes, yeah. You hate me?
Yeah. Mary's solution to that, to yeah. your solution to the voicemail problem is just leave your mailbox full.
My mailbox
all the time.
Is full. Nobody can.
I think your mailbox has been full since I met you.
It's been full for like 5 years. You know what it is?
I think my wife does that.
And I also don't care.
Yes, it is just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah. She's just a cost benefit
like,
analysis.
I'll call you back or I won't, or you can text me.
That's hilarious. I think, go ahead.
No, please go.
I was going to say, I think my wife's is the same way. And I've often noticed that if I need to get my wife to text me back, I need to include a picture of the dogs.
Actually,
that's perfect.
I'm thinking about it now. That's when yeah. you respond. I'll send just like a video from the dog park. And sometimes yes. it'll just be, haha, look, turnip's peeing. And yeah. it's not funny or interesting. And Mary will just be like, why did you send me that? I think the other day I texted you a few times and you hadn't answered. So I was like, look at Georgie's poop. Isn't it so cute?
I think I did respond to that one.
Right? I know. When my wife answers, I'm like, oh, so you are getting these. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I see how it is. As we're reflecting, I think it came out of like back when I, like before I had like this job, I think it was from like bill collectors. I was like, I don't want to deal with that.
I don't need that.
Because if you get a parking ticket, if you put it in the glove box, it goes away.
Yes.
And it's the same with most bills. It's a magic
door. I have no idea about that.
It's like the guy in the suit with the question marks all over it who's telling you like money secrets. That's one of them. The government doesn't want you to know. There are no debtors' prisons in the U.S. anymore. People forget that.
I don't think I've ever told this story, but I don't think I've ever told you this because I kind of forgot.
You better get it all out now before the wedding.
So like it was when I signed the label, and so they had me on this like crazy year, right? And mm-hmm. they were like, okay, you're flying to London, you know, in 2 weeks, do you have your passport? I was like, oh, I don't have a passport. I didn't think I was going to live. Like, I didn't think I was going to live past however old I was. And so my manager was like, okay, we'll get an expedited passport. And then he like calls me. He's like, you had a court summons you didn't show up to. And I apparently like owed like so much money, and I had like there was like
to the court.
Yeah, it was like 10 grand.
Oh my god.
And I didn't know, and my license was suspended, and I didn't know.
That's amazing.
I was like, that is the time in my life. That was a time that I had.
Yeah. I think it's kind of sexy. You're like on the lam from the law, kind of.
I just didn't. I was unaware. Cool. And so Dylan was like, well, we have to, you can't get a passport. Like, we have to take care of this. So he had to do all of this stuff. It was a mess. But I was like, thank you.
That story had a happy ending. That's all that matters. It's true. You know, I'll be happy to take on all of your responsibility for all of your debts. There better not be any more. Catherine, I want to ask, this has been on my mind just because I was like, I was so interested when at a point in your podcast, you made the decision to actually capitalize on how amazing and popular and useful it was. And you, you had ads at the beginning of your podcasts. Mm-hmm. And the response from people was so bizarre to me. Like, I'm not trying to crap on anybody but like, I was just in Instagram comments, like furiously responding to people because it was just such an absurd, like the Thank whole you. Thing just seemed so strange to me.
Yeah.
And you don't have to address like that specifically, but I'm just really curious as somebody who has such a successful podcast and has so many listeners, and I wonder too if like
for free
that there's that intimacy, I think, of like,
yeah,
no, maybe because people feel like they know you better than they do, because, and this happens with you too,
oh my god, yeah,
because you have intimate part of their lives, but yeah, it seemed like sort of an entitlement to be overly critical of you. And you don't have to speak about anything that you're not comfortable
I'm
talking
happy
about
to.
Of course, but yeah, I just love to know what that's been like for
you. You know, it shocked me at first because, you know, I feel like I had given so much for free for so long. And because I've listened to podcasts, I was like an early adopter. I listened to podcasts from the beginning of podcasts, and I understood how podcasts work and how people were paid. So when I would listen to podcasts that were like little podcasts and then they would get bigger and then they would get ads, I would be like, oh, this is fantastic. Good for them. They're getting paid. I'd be so excited. So I kind of thought people might feel that way about me, and probably lots of them did, but those aren't the ones who send you messages and leave reviews on Apple. Right. So there's, you know, that's the thing about like when you have like a bad experience, you tell 12 people. When you have a good experience, you tell 2, you know, it's that response that we have, you know. And I think also because in that moment when people are falling asleep is quite vulnerable. And so for me to be close to them, there's that intimacy there. And I think they felt betrayed. I think a lot of people just didn't understand. You know, one person one of the things that was really helpful from another podcaster was you don't have to answer everyone. And that's really important. And I remind myself a lot. But one person who I did answer, like really got very personal and was like, obviously followed me all over and knew different things about me. Was like, you have a successful book. You have a successful yoga studio. You have this big podcast. You must make so much money. You are being so greedy. Why are you doing this to people? And I had to say, you don't know how much my book made. Mm-hmm. And it came out in 2020 and my book tour was canceled. Mm. And it came out a couple weeks before the election. So do you think I could get a single interview about it?
God, yeah.
My yoga studio has been closed because of COVID for 10 months and it might fail.
Good Lord, yeah.
And no matter what, I don't have to explain to you how I make my money. That's disrespectful to me. There's no reason I would need to justify to you the circumstances of my life in order to be paid for the work that I do.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, and so that was, I made a little video where I just kind of came out to people and I said, like, here are the rules.
Yep.
You know, you have to respect that, you know, I as a creator deserve to be paid. I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm not going to wring my hands about it. It is just the way it is. Now I'm very careful. Every single ad is in my voice. You'll never hear another ad voice on my podcast unless there is a slip up. Oh, here comes the cuckoo clock. Can you go to? you know, and every once in a while we've had a problem, we get it fixed as soon as possible, but I'm very careful about it. And Bob is so careful about it. And, you know, I just said, so you can't say nasty things about me. It's not acceptable. You can't, you know, imply that I'm money grubbing because I want to be paid for my work. It is just the nature of, you know, artists deserve to be paid as much as everybody else. It's funny because I think that people just weren't, a lot of people just didn't realize that podcasters don't get paid.
Right.
Without that. And so, because somebody said to me, oh my gosh, you have all these millions of downloads. You must be raking it in. I was like, from what? Are you paying for this? Are you paying? And she was like, it never occurred to me that I'm not paying. And I'm like, well, then I'm not getting paid. You know, yeah. So it took me maybe till my second 2.5. It was really only, I'd say, 8 months ago that I really could reliably live from the work that I do in an artistic way. Wow, so, yeah. You know, and people, as long as you are a person speaking in the world, you are going to be criticized.
Right.
That is part of it. You know, people will still criticize my voice. People will criticize, you know, often I say at the before the story starts, you know, I try to insert some compassionate words and I was saying, you know, things like, you're safe. Mm. The day is over. Set it down. I'm going to be here watching over with my voice. And people got mad at me about that.
What was the objection to that?
That I must be so privileged to not realize that not everyone is safe.
Oh my God.
And I said, of course, I know everyone is not safe. I'm trying to speak it into existence. I'm trying to help you to feel safe, even if you are not, because you deserve peace at the end of the day. It's not that I don't know, you know, and one person was just like, this is so unhelpful. She was just like, swore up and down. And I was like, okay, I'm going to block you, but first I'm just going to have a teaching moment and say why it's not okay to do this, you know?
I remember the video where you defended yourself. I mean, really not even defending yourself. You were laying out boundaries. I think you were in your car, right? In that video.
Yeah.
And Mary and I were both like, wow, she did a really good job with that. It was like, and you don't do it. You know, it's like we very rarely see you in that capacity, like speaking directly. So it was really like a good, it made that like, oh shit, I need to pay attention.
Yeah, it was
And it was just really succinct, and like you really stood up for yourself and established those boundaries in a way that I thought was just like it was really inspiring to me.
Oh,
and
good.
It was not that you said like I'm not going to apologize for this, and I can't help but think that it's like it seems specifically directed at women. Really often, like this idea of like, how dare you try to monetize your labor?
Yeah.
Like it's weird. It seems like it happens to women a lot more than it does to men. It's just really, I mean, I say it's strange. It's the patriarchy. It's there, but
100 million for Joe Rogan and we can't run an ad, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think especially for women's voices, women's voices are criticized so much. And I hear from so many other women podcasters who are like, how come I can't seem to get it right? There's no way for me to, I'm like, it's not you. It's not your voice. You have to just stop, you know, responding. And sometimes I just stop looking at reviews and stuff because sometimes it really does bum me out. People get very personal about that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the group that never, ever complains about ads are my followers on YouTube because they expect there to be ads.
Oh, right. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And those ads aren't even in my voice. I have no control over what those ads are. Not a single complaint. People understand.
And as amazing as like, I mean, as beautiful and perfect as the content is, I mean, so much of what makes your podcast so special is that you do have just this incredibly soothing, pleasant voice. And it's not and that's the thing that really weirded me out about the complaints about the ads was I was like, I would listen to you read the repair manual for a Mazda Miata. I mean, and it's not like you're like, okay, ad time. And you're like, ladies and gentlemen, do you need help buying postage? Like it's in your regular voice.
Stamps.com.
No free ad. Stamps.com. If you want us to include that, sponsor the pod.
100 million minimum.
Oh, yeah. Is
this
that
is
tiny?
Ladybug. This one's Ladybug.
Okay, yes, this is a reason to subscribe on Patreon. Like, these dogs are right out of this world. Out of this world.
Baby. Yeah. Stick around. I'll maybe even bring out the littlest one.
Kissing you.
She's so such a lover.
This is, I can't believe I'm telling the story, and like, this is my moment to stop telling it and turn around. But I'm just gonna keep going.
Too late.
That Georgie, I mean, will just, of course, she's a dog. She will smell and eat and roll around in anything. I mean, right, any animal's feces, any, you know, any yeah, offal that she finds, anything. And yet in the morning, some, like, I will sometimes, she'll be like laying up in bed with me, and I'll take my night guard out, you know, for the, mm-hmm, that I wear because I grind my teeth, and I'll take it out, and she'll get kind of close to me and smell it and be like, oh, like she, it's like,
she recoils.
Too much.
She emerged from the woods last week with a fucking spine.
Yeah, an entire deer's spine dangling from her mouth. I hope it was a deer. I don't know it well enough, gosh, to recognize like deer pelvises, but I thought it was like a branch or like a lay or something, but no.
It was well composed, decomposed.
It had been perfectly
intact, licked clean. I mean, who knows?
Oh my gosh.
But she was so proud. She just trotted with her head up, and
I've never seen her so happy.
It was just,
yeah, beautiful. I know, when my dogs turn down carrots, I'm like, really? I've seen you poop. You were not going to eat a carrot.
Okay. Eat each other's feces.
You're like, now right, you're going to be precious? Good, okay.
And I remember, too, you made, there was a, you have, you, when you involve your partner in your stories, you call her your sweetheart.
Yes.
And I just always really love that.
I do, too.
And I remember there, that being sort of a conversation as well, you know?
Oh, also, yeah, when we realized that you, like, when we read your, when, wherever we read, I don't remember.
Yeah.
When you revealed that you were gay, we, like, it was like we won the Super Bowl.
I was like, queer hero.
We were like, I knew it! This is
awesome. So many people email me that. They're like, I just knew it. I knew it.
I know.
I think there's something there about just sort of like our queerdar, where you're like, oh, this person gets like the safety that I need, and it feels like so welcoming. And, you know, so it was always really important to me when I would write any kind of romantic relationship into the podcast that I not use gender pronouns, so that whoever's, I always think the stories are about you. So when, mm-hmm, you listen to them, you pull them around your shoulders and you think of yourself being in that moment and populated in the way that you do. But it was also important to me that we had non-binary people in the village. So there are a few characters who you'll hear use they, them pronouns.
Woohoo!
And when I, you know, a lot of times people don't notice, but of course the people who do notice are the people who feel seen by it. And oh, I just, yes, had a really sweet story about one of my Christmas stories, and that happens, there's like the innkeeper of the village, and I really love her storyline. I could write a whole book about the innkeeper, but the chef at the inn uses they, them pronouns. And I got this really sweet email from this person who was saying, I'm just about to start culinary school, and I am they, them. Oh. And I just heard this, and I felt like this is my story. And I was like, it is. It is your story. Because just like every single neighborhood in the world, every village in the world are all kinds of people. They are all of our neighbors. It is the same in the village of Nothing Much. So it is definitely like an idealized place. I totally get that. But that's okay. I feel like as adults, like, don't we need our own like Mr. Rogers neighborhood?
Oh my God.
I think they do.
I mean, I think you've made it. I think you made it with, yeah, the village.
I think so too. Right? Just the community of people, like, and I get so excited when I'll see somebody, like, there is some crossover with our podcast listeners, because there are some people who follow the podcast and will interact with us on Twitter, and then will like comment something about, oh my God, I love the description of the kittens, and Nothing Much Happens last night, and I listened, yeah, to it again today, and I'll be like, oh my God, right, yes, on. I feel like,
yeah, that's
as queer people, like you said, like, seeking a sense of community and seeking a sense of calm. It's like, you, I think you know when you hear somebody else off extending that kind of welcoming, like leaving, for sure, space for you. Yeah. And yeah, I think you doing that is as profound as like you having a song like She Keeps Me Warm, where it's like, mm-hmm, I'm not going to be ambiguous about who this is about. Yeah. Like, this is about me being, yeah, me. And yet at the same time, people can see their own stories in it. Totally. They can see their own love in it. Right.
Right.
What was it though, that somebody said something about the sweetheart? It was like somebody, I mean,
just, oh, yeah, they were bothered by it.
I mean, just, but honestly, I feel like, and like you said, it's, I heard, recently this kind of justification for why we tend to, you know, focus in and obsess on negative comments or criticism more than we remember positivity and positive criticism. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, I mean, I guess it seems obvious, but positivity is not a threat to you. And we are sort of evolved to pay more attention to threats. So when we see criticism,
it's that negativity bias.
Right. That negativity
bias.
It's
a cognitive dissonance. Yeah. It's this huge, you know, thing to be aware of. And it's something that I would teach so much in yoga that, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off. I just got excited about this idea that I've spoken about for so long. So, you know, like you were saying, you know, if our ancestors were crossing the savannah and did not stop to smell a flower, okay, no big deal. But if they did not pay attention to the predator animal behind them, they might not get their genes into the next generation. So worrywarts had more kids. So it is built into our brain to give more weight to scary stuff, to give more importance to things that are upsetting. And so, of course, you know, if you just spend, you know, I often think about how by 10 o'clock in the morning, I have taken in a million times more information than one of my ancestors who lived 150 years ago might have had in their whole life.
Right.
And so we can so easily drown in all that negativity and very terrifying real world problems. I'm not telling people to pretend that they're not real, but when you pay more attention deliberately in the mindful way, like a regular practice of looking for things that are good and simply saying, oh, that's nice. You aren't putting on rose colored glasses. You are taking off the gray ones. And right. that is actually giving you like a better sense of balance and perspective of what the world really is than you would have without that kind of practice.
Right. Oh, that's such a good point. Like that you aren't rewarded, like your family lineage, your ancestors were not rewarded for like stopping to meditate on things that were good. And we, And every time there is that a little bit of negativity or a little bit of criticism, I think you can feel your like nervous system being like, oh my God, am I going to be exiled from the community? Am I going to lose my support system? Does everybody hate me?
Absolutely.
Does everybody secretly think this? And I've always found a lot of comfort in that line, that little cliche that I've heard, what other people think of you is none of your business. Mm-hmm. I know that's so silly, but I also, as the poet the poet Rihanna once said, people are going to talk whether you're doing bad or good. I think that's also very comforting. There's something to that idea of like, just, you know, what it was to paraphrase one of your stories, like let it come in the front door and out the back door, but don't let it stay for tea.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously I'm like knee deep in my workshop right now. So all I'm thinking about is how this relates to bodies and how we feel about our own selves and like move through the world. But I think that it just totally touches on that. If you're not constantly trying to be better, to do better, to look better, to be more attractive, be desirable, then you're failing, you know, like that.
Absolutely.
And when people look in the mirror, not only do they see like their body as a failing, they're seeing a reflection of like a moral failure as well.
Yeah. And so judgment, right?
Yeah. And being very quick to be able to identify in the ways that they have failed, I think is... I never considered it as something that would be evolutionary, you know, that would be have been something that, grew out of your ancestors, you know, but
you know, there's several things
serve you.
You're right. There are several things that we inherited through evolution that kind of stink. I would talk about it a lot in yoga that, you know, evolution didn't necessarily create us to be the best possible way that we could be. It just had to make sure that we didn't die before we had the next generation.
Right.
So there are things like the hair trigger on our fight or flight that, you know, just does not really help us out in our day-to-day life. It might have helped us our ancestors out, but the world has changed. And I want to say, Mary, I'm so excited that you do those workshops. I think it is such important work. I'm just about to celebrate my third year of recovery from eating disorders. Yeah, thank you. I'm in a really good place now. I was sick for almost 30 years and my sickness was a big part of unfortunately, why I became a yoga teacher. You're always, you know, it was masked in all that BS and wellness culture. And so I spent the last few years of my career as a teacher trying to pull all that stuff down and to teach in a way that honored joyful movement, and that replaced the idea of should or supposed to with what feels good, and to remind people that they deserve pleasure no matter how their body looks or works. And so it was such a huge part of my work. I would often play Marry Your Music in my yoga studio. So it feels like such like a full circle moment to feel connected to you in that way. I now live in a larger body because of my recovery, and I'm mm-hmm. so glad that she is the size that she needed to be. I love her so dearly in a way that I never did before my recovery, but it's just really helpful to see that support in the world and see other people, you know, working through that and finding a better way to live.
Totally. Oh my God. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm like so happy for you that you are like, you are home in yourself.
Yeah. I feel really safe here.
That's such a blessing. God,
it's beautiful.
Yeah. And so did yoga grow with you through those changes, or did you find it empowering in like, as you felt more at home in your body and were sort of maybe leaving some of those behaviors behind, was yoga more challenging or more enjoyable or the same?
More enjoyable for sure. And I think because I own my own studio and had always been, I am good at setting boundaries. I am good at like making that stuff. I was like, here's the way that we teach yoga. And as like I became more enlightened over the year, I was like, and we screwed that up. So everyone needs to understand why we don't say these things anymore, why we don't teach with that perspective. And here's the new perspective. Let me help you understand why and how to implement it. And my staff was really wonderful. And because I opened a yoga studio in a place where there were no yoga studios, I had like raised everybody up from babies. And so they were like, they were so open and trusting to me to like lead them. So even when I would come in and have like a mea culpa, like I screwed that up and be accountable for it and explain why we're moving in a new direction. You know, my students followed and were grateful. And so, you know, and then in my own personal practice, you know, I'd often had, I think this is common for a lot of people with eating disorders or probably a wide range of conditions, I had that thing of like, make a rule and now make a religion around it. And for me, that was my yoga practice. I practiced every day for years. And if I didn't practice, God, the guilt I would feel, the shame I would feel about it. Almost like I feel like it's kind of like in eating disorders when you feel like one wrong meal will give you cancer or something. You know, it's like these ridiculous ideas that we have built up around it. And so to shed that and then move completely out of joy for the feeling of the movement, or to rest for weeks and not move because my body was really tired and did not want to move and feel totally at peace and actually like, oh, I've done like, I'm a good steward of my body today. That was wonderful. And I felt like I was stepping into, a role as a teacher and a student that was more true to yoga than I had ever been in the past. Oh, I feel like I had been manipulated like we all are by diet culture. But then I was in the really shitty position of then having been part of manipulating other people. And coming to terms with that and then trying to make it right was kind of like I said before, like when you find the confidence to do the thing because it's going to help other people, that helped me pull through that part of my recovery and not get stuck in the shame. Because I was like, but I got to fix it for everybody who trusts me as my as their teacher. Okay, let's do this. And that put me in a really, really good place.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that you asked that, and that you that answer was just so beautiful, Catherine. That idea that like yoga, I guess, is like a practice expansive enough that you just welcome your growth with open arms. Like it's the kind of like, I guess because of the nature of it. And I imagine that meditation and mindfulness practice is much the same way, where it's like, I have the tools that you needed. I've had the tools all along. And now that you're in a place to use them, oh my gosh, that must just be like, you know, discovering a whole new set of tools within that world.
You left the Sith and you joined the Jedi. You used your powers for good.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Because the practice stays the same, but when you look at it through this new lens, it's totally different. It's so much more freeing. It's about, you know, I talk a lot, when a lot of people ask me the question, like, how do I improve my sleep hygiene? I always talk about pleasure, because I feel like, you know, if you write feeling good. It needs to be part of your self-care plan. If it isn't, you're missing. Self-care should be, there should be these elements of pleasure, and you can only make yourself do stuff you don't enjoy for so long. And so if, you know, your movement practice or your mindfulness practice or the things you do before bed involve things that make you feel good, mm-hmm. boy, are you going to do them a lot more often? Boy, are you going to look forward to them? And they're going to become these parts of your life that don't feel like chores, but just feel like, oh yeah, I get to do that thing. Okay, I'll do that.
Yes, that was a really, it was a hugely transformative moment for me to realize I enjoyed running of its own, like, because it gave me pleasure instead of the connotation it had previously, which was that running was punishment. It was punishment. Yeah. It was awful. Like every image I had of it was like sweating and having side stitches and hating it and my teachers making me do it. And, and just realizing that just one day waking up and being like, I want to run today just because it'll feel good. And I want to stop if it doesn't feel good. Like being able, realizing you can rediscover that. And I imagine that for a lot of people in recovery, there is that process of discovering the joy, like as Catherine, as you said, like joyful movement, not punitive movement.
Totally. Because we view, especially with people with eating disorders, viewing like exercise or movement as compensatory for food. Yeah. Like that there's really, and that's why I think the harm and danger is really in saying calories in, calories out is really harmful of like, first of all, it's not really how it works anyway. Like, we know that, also it makes you feel like you're supposed to be doing something, which I think again is that like mechanism of capitalism to be like, this is how you should be productive.
Right. Like, do you want that cupcake? You can pay for it in the form of your blood, sweat and tears of an hour's worth of synchronized walking.
And there are no flags to slow you down.
You walk as fast as you want, baby.
Yeah. Well, what do you think?
I'm not done. Keep going. There's so many things I want to ask you, but
go right ahead.
We don't want to keep you all night, but I know that I see Mary itching to not move on.
I'm wondering, do you have any? this is such a tough question, but I'm excited because you're here. Do you have any like are a vocal inspirations? Like you're like I love that person's voice, like they sound.
Yes, and I used to talk about this in teacher training, how you should have sort of like voice role models.
Ooh.
And because I think that there's a way, I'm sure Mary, you feel this like so much in what you do, like to use your voice that opens people up and helps them drop resistance to hearing you. And I was so aware of that as a yoga teacher, because it's such a moment where people would feel vulnerable, that I was always like, how do I go? I don't want to be like a knife in a stream of water that cuts across you. I want to go with you. I want you to feel like I'm next to you. So we're both open to moving forward. I don't know if you guys have ever heard The Splendid Table. This is so old, but it was an NPR. It was an NPR food show, and it's still going, but the woman who was on it was Lynn Rosetta Casper, and she was my voice role model. And she had this way of, people would call up with cooking questions, and sometimes they would be idiotic. And she would, I remember this one person was like, when I fry chicken, I empty the oil out, you know, like you do, and then I put water in the pan, and my chicken comes out really soggy. Oh, and I'm a vegan, and I was like, soggy? What? I don't think that's how you do it. And you could hear Lynn go, okay, so let's start together. And she had just this way of immediately being your friend and making you feel totally okay with whatever you showed up with. And we're just going to start here and go forward. And her voice was so warm and inviting. Mm. And I just like remember like clicking into it and going, that's where I need to be as a teacher.
Awesome.
And then being able to take that with me, you know, so sometimes it's like the most random thing. But when you hear that in somebody else, like that ability to like have no defensiveness and no ego about it, but just be like, oh, like, so you're there. Okay, let me come to you. And then we'll go from there to here.
Right.
That's like the best skill as a teacher.
It really is such a like, and that's what when I'm teaching, I feel like I've sometimes had those moments where even with, you know, students who, like, if we're talking about something kind of controversial, will say something I don't totally agree with, or I don't totally think is like an idea that I really want to promote in class. And I'll have that moment, like I'll kind of catch myself like the water in the fried chicken pan. I'll be like, okay, so let me collect by way of how I feel about this, but getting in that like space of not being judgmental, like that sort of getting yourself into that zen space of like, I'm just going to accept and sort of deal with what's happening. And also for me, it was like part of it when I developed like a community in the classroom would be trusting that I didn't have to be the one exerting control, that eventually there was something really powerful about sort of like letting that moment sit and letting people negotiate it together, like sort of, you know, and yeah, it's just something special. I think teaching is just such an interesting performance of meeting people where they are, letting go of your ego, which I have learned is critically important and I have not mastered. I will not. You can take my ego out of my cold dead hands. But yeah, it's a struggle sometimes.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and you're teaching too.
I mean, yes, in my way, but I think too, it's very hard. So like on Tuesdays on the first part of the class, we like, it's a lot. It's like mostly me just like talking about diet culture. Like I'm just like lecturing and we do like different exercises. But on the second day of the workshop, it's like I put people into breakout rooms and they sort of discuss, you know, certain concepts or their relationship to, you know, this specific experience of like, you know, dieting or whatever that's like. And I have to let go. I can't be in 10 breakout rooms. And I have to let go. And every time I go, I'm like, make a choice.
Are you nervous? Yeah.
I'm dropping all of my kids off to kindergarten.
I imagine you're probably worried about not being able to like monitor what people are saying.
I'm like, oh, I don't want to know. I get triggered. Oh, I don't want to, you know. And I think, I'm sure there is some like liability issue in me running essentially group therapy for 100 people. But but I think it is. It's not set up that way. And also like you have to trust that people are going to take care of themselves.
Right.
Like, and that it's a very difficult thing to negotiate. And you also want to be a steward of your own lesson, you know, be kind.
Yeah.
And like, what is the deepest, most kindest way to approach the specific position?
Right.
Yeah. I think, you know, maybe you can relate to this as somebody who like my whole career has looked for ways to heal other people. I was deeply codependent. So I'm so grateful, like therapy, especially over the last couple of years, because it was a big part of coming through recovery, has brought me so far along the road of letting other people feel the feeling, even if it's icky and uncomfortable, and maybe they are triggered, and maybe that's a useful thing because it's going to help us trace back to where it started and all that stuff. And just in yoga, we would always say like learning to sit in your own fire. And then when you learn how to do that, then you can let other people sit in theirs. And that's often the hardest part for the people who are always like reaching out to heal. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of just like therapy for me. And so now I often find myself in that moment where I can see Mary, like you were saying, like, I hope this goes well, but like, I'm not responsible for how this person feels. And actually it aids them more to let me step back and let them sit in their fire.
Yes. I love that. I love that phrase.
I needed to hear that today. Cause I had a really hard
so glad
today.
Did you, was it like particularly difficult kind of topic?
No, I mean, we're talking about like representation and narrative, and the assignment I give is like, what would you, if you had a bajillion dollars and a whole network behind you, what story would you want to tell and who would you cast and why would you make those, you know, decisions? Like, if you wanted to make somebody in the story like you that had your exact same intersections, like what would that be like? And so it's not like a super, it doesn't have to be super touchy, but it's like, I think it's because it's the first breakout room thing.
So yes.
It's just hard. It's hard. And I love them. And I want to be able to see their faces so I can get that feedback. And when you talk, Catherine, about, you know, being codependent, I mean, I think this is the first relationship that I've been in where I feel like there was a real transformative element of our relationship of trust and like knowing that we can take care of ourselves and in our own sort of spaces.
Yes. Yeah.
And being able to have our own growth. And I think you experienced that too with like quitting drinking.
Absolutely.
And like being able to say like, if if you gave me an ultimatum, whether to stay with you or take a if in order to stay with you, I had to take a shot of tequila, I would not be with you.
Right.
You know, yeah. It was like a really powerful thing to hear, you know?
Realize. And I think that's difficult. Like, there's no expiration date on when you can rediscover yourself in that way and like rediscover your own abilities. Like, that isn't finite. That's something that you can always do. And I think speaking of trust, you know, in teaching, I think they call it gradual release. Like, we'll do things together. I'll show you how to do it. We'll do them together. And then I'm going to kind of like, I just think of like my dad teaching me how to ride a bike. Eventually he's going to be behind me pushing me and he's going to let go. And even though, I mean, I'm thinking back on my own experiences of being in classes and, you know, having to do group work and, you know, hearing somebody say something where I was like, oh, wait. But I just learned in lecture or something like that doesn't feel right. And that's kind of part of the process, right? Is like letting people sift through ideas on their own. Mm-hmm. And you can give them guidance and give them models, but you know, like ultimately you're empowering them to see that of their own accord. And you know, like you're giving them, like I like to think in my, like when I teach students rhetoric, I'm giving them like a new set of glasses to see the world differently, right? Totally. And it takes time to adjust to that, I think.
Yeah. And as you were talking about self-care too, I was thinking about like, you know, self-care, not being putting on rose-colored glasses, but taking the gray ones off. I just love that you said that, Catherine. And I was also thinking about like, so often we frame self-care as like what we're adding into our practice, but it's also about what you're not doing, like what you're omitting from your practice. You know? Like, what can you set down that is causing you turmoil? That is something that is within your control, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Those are having the boundaries too, like around, you know, who you're following and what you're watching and, you know, all those sort of things that can be really toxic.
Yes. For real.
So speaking of toxic, I don't know why that wasn't a great transition.
I was like, my bowl, are we going to play Britney or?
That was a very.
We can't afford it, Catherine.
I'm sure.
That was really triggering for me. Okay. So you, Catherine, you get suggestions for stories, right? From your listeners.
Yes, I do.
Now, I do. We decided to, that was my segue into this segment specifically designed for Catherine. So we've decided that in that spirit, we are each going to pitch a sleep story to you and you have to choose which one you want to green light. And this is actually legally binding. Mm-hmm. We are going to claim all of the proceeds from that particular episode. Correct?
Exactly. Yes. Okay. Yes. So when you decide this will be, when you pick mine, you will... I feel like we have future in sleep stories.
I think so too.
And also I'm dying to know like things that people have pitched.
Oh my God, me too.
But I don't want you to be, you know, I want this to be like the best things that people have pitched.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's going to be no comparison. So we're going to do just sort of an intro, just a taste, a little teaser of these stories. Okay.
So I've put on my fancy glasses and I'm ready.
I feel like you're taking us really seriously, and honestly, you should.
Go ahead, baby, please.
Okay. My story tonight is about poison ivy, how bad it hurts, where it hurts, and why it hurts. It's also about a cat named Glenn, a cup of dirty poop water, and cinder blocks filled with hundreds of spiders outside my friend Tiffany's house from 1996. It's also about finding yourself, having courage, and keeping promises. The day started like any other. Tea on the stove, my filthy toes on the floor, and Apple Jacks for breakfast. I peeked outside and saw the disgusting sun pouring through the curtains. Yuck! Oh my God. So I closed the curtain and turned on Maury. That's when the itching began. First itch, then scratch. Did I kill it? The Apple Jacks.
I'm going to do this in a really Hollywood way. Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
We love it. Everybody loves it. We can't get enough of it. We think it should We think the whole thing is wonderful. And so we think it should be a show. We maybe think it should be a movie. But it's definitely going to happen, and I'll definitely email you. You'll definitely hear from me again.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited for my movie deal.
You don't take offers like that very seriously.
Right?
Danny, you think you're going to best me?
Honestly, no. That was really good. I don't think, but I'm going to try. Our story tonight is on the assembly line. It's about efficiency, patience, and the extended cab Chevy Silverado 1500. It's also about workers' rights and revolution. With a sigh, Kara used a grease-stained towel. Damn it, sorry. I forgot a verb.
Bob can fix it.
Yeah, thanks. Bob, I'm going to just have a little Bob button. Okay.
Okay.
With a sigh, Kara wiped her brow with a grease-stained towel. With a grating screech, and I know you don't do sound effects, but I'd put a sound effect in here, like a mechanical scream. A giant metal claw, like the ones that might grasp hopelessly at a teddy bear in a game at the fair, churned in her direction. The hulking frame of a truck lurched toward her, dangling from its jaws.
Oh my God!
She rolled up the sleeves of her jacket and began snaking the wiring for the truck's headlights through the frame. Ow, she exclaimed. And I'd really like yell that part. Like I'd really scream that. Ow!
Yeah,
like
you can get
naturally.
That.
Yeah. Just because like I know people are trying to fall asleep, but I also want them to be invested and to drive home like how much it hurt as the soulless arm of the robot bumped her elbow. And so that's it. But from there, we kind of get into like Marx's theory of alienation of labor and like the history of the United Auto Workers Union. And I know that as a Michigander, that's probably really close to your heart. So
I was going to say, I am from, it kind of worked though, because I am from Flint. My grandfather very proudly was in the sit-down strike. It is in my blood. I grew up a couple blocks from Chevy in the hole. So this one gets the green light. Yeah.
Oh!
I just got the green light. Thank you, Catherine. This is an honor. I will have my people draw up the contract. I'll have my guy H&R Block.
Mine's more of a visual thing. Mine's more big picture.
That's right. You're getting
the feature.
You're getting
and
a movie.
We love it.
I'm going to have an episode on the podcast. Like, it all evens out. Thank you for that, Catherine. That was really fun. I have a whole new respect for your craft, by the way. I was like, this is kind of challenging, but I decided to go with the most unsettling images I could. So.
Me too.
Yeah, the center of the spiders was a real piece of artwork. It's time to talk about our obsessions.
Oh my God, yes.
Are you ready?
Yes.
What's your first one, if you want to go ahead?
What's your first one?
My first one is your appearance on Tamron Hall today.
Oh my, first obsession is my appearance on Tamron Hall today.
Well, it's really about me more than you. I think they'd probably rather hear it from me, right?
Like, yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. No, but you talk about it, please. It was amazing. Mary did an interview about her post that went viral about her experience getting an MRI and how, you know, like kind of shitty that was.
Yes.
And Tamron was amazing. She's and please sweet. Talk about it.
She was so, so sweet. And I just honestly like just a masterclass in like just like telling a story and listening. Like, I don't know, like the producers did such a great job in such a short amount of time of like really allowing me to hammer some of my like principles down about like, you know, like size inclusivity in in the medical industry is like the bare fucking minimum for bodies, you know? And so it felt very good to just like talk about it. And especially with a host that was so warm and like as outraged as I was. 'Cause I think there's sometimes when you have like a vulnerability hangover where like after I shared it and it was like getting picked up everywhere. And like, I mean, just the hordes of like vile things that was just like constantly, like almost like every minute just getting pummeled by cruel things. It feels like, was it as bad as I thought it was?
And you start to like gaslight yourself, right?
I was grateful for you to just keep, it was awful. It was awful. It was there. It was bad.
Yeah.
Was like, okay.
And it was totally unacceptable. Like it was absolutely, it is like an unacceptable sort of social contagion that people think that that's okay is just, it's miserable. And like, yeah, Tamron was just so like empathetic and warm and said like, yeah, I know what you're experiencing is so important. Like being a marginalized person going to the doctor, and she sort of connected it to her own experiences being a Black woman and being pregnant and seeking medical care. And like the number of Black women who die in childbirth, like the rates are outrageous. And just like her genuine warmth and feeling for you. And you just did such a wonderful job. Like, we're downplaying your role here of like, that it's scary after that onslaught of people being awful. There were so many people who were like, I had an awful experience too. I'm so glad you're talking about this. And you just like, you were brave to do it again, you know? Yeah.
Thank you.
And it was the national TV debut of the Manic episodes, because they put our artwork on the screen, and I screamed. It was amazing.
That's so great.
So cool. I was like, that's us.
Well done, Mary.
Thank you.
It's so important. I think a lot of people who have thin privilege don't even know. They have no idea what goes on. You know, I was talking to my psychiatrist a little while ago, and going over meds and stuff. And I was explaining, he was like, well, why don't you go, like, you haven't been to the doctor in so long. And I'm like, it's a really awful experience. And I often don't get care. So it often feels pointless and just traumatic. And you know, I was explaining to him how it works for people in larger bodies. And he went, I don't think that's a thing.
Oh, no.
Wow.
And I was like, no, this is like me not knowing what it's like to be pulled over by the police as a Black person. I don't know what that experience is like because of my privilege. You don't know what my experience is like because of your thin privilege, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to you.
Right.
Like, so it is so, so important to tell these stories.
The inability of, you know, I kind of remember having my own awakening in this way of being like, oh my God, I really haven't been able to see past my own nose. Like I was so closed off to the idea that people had such different experiences, and that people were like, you can trust people to be, you know, communicators of messengers of their own fucking experience in the world.
Yes. Like, it's their lived experience.
Right. And I've talked a lot about how, in my first, in the first year actually of being at my institution, there was an instance of a student who had like racist graffiti, a student of color, somebody wrote a piece of racist graffiti on her dorm room door. And I remember this, you know, somebody who no longer works at the institution, but we were in a meeting and this person said, well, you know, I heard that they wrote it on their own door, that the whole thing was a hoax. And I was like, to find comfort, like, I get why you find comfort in the idea that that didn't happen, because then you don't have to worry about students of color on our campus.
Yeah.
You yourself as a white person are not implicated in this. Like, I get that that's a comforting fantasy, but it's really unhelpful.
And
I was like, God, I just hope you're not saying this in your classes. Like, please, God, just don't, you know, but,
please have several seats.
Take 8th chair on the flute. My goodness.
Catherine, do you have an obsession you want to share?
Yes, please.
Something you're about right now.
This is really simple, but have you ever made butter tomato sauce?
No.
Okay, so I use vegan butter. I use Miyoko's vegan butter because it's amazing.
Miyoko's products are so good.
They're fantastic. I've been vegan so long that I'm like the old vegan who's like, in my day, I had to walk uphill to, you know, like there was no food. And now, like, you can have like every kind of aioli that you want. Yeah. And I used to live in Southern Italy. I was a foreign exchange student. And I lived there in my junior year of high school. I still speak fluent Italian and I'm very close with my family. And this is not how they would make tomato sauce, so don't tell anybody. but it is amazing. And you could just Google it, like butter tomato sauce, but it's like a lot of butter.
Love it.
And then like half an onion, just cut it in half and put it in the pot. And then take like a big can of peeled Italian, like San Marzano tomatoes. And as you take them out, you just squish them so that they break apart. And then you just simmer it for like 40 minutes and eat it with pasta, or eat it out of the pot with a spoon. It is amazing.
Honestly, my mouth is watering. My mouth is watering. And also, as has happened to me with your podcast so many times, just like hearing you talk about food, I'm like, I mean, I'm sure people joke with you about this all the time, but I'm going to fall asleep. That's just so comforting.
Oh, good. It's glad. Like, so that's an obsession. Yeah, you know, I very specifically write about food. I want people to take pleasure in the comfort of food, yes, and to have that. And every once in a while, people will say, stop doing this, I'm so hungry. And then I say, then please go eat.
Yeah,
baby. Yes. If you are hungry, my dear,
yeah, go eat. I think about writing about food much the way I think about people who are really good about writing about music. Like, it's very hard to do. And yeah. I think you have to have such a deep knowledge and appreciation of food and the interaction of flavors and ingredients. And so it's just such a joy to read in the book and to hear on the podcast. Yeah. Anytime you talk about
it. And to hear just now.
Yeah, just now.
Yeah. What about you, honey?
So my first obsession, I only have two today. It's low obsessive rating this week, but I am reading, after like a million years of having it on my shelf and probably telling people that I'd already read it, I'm actually reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, the big ass book about Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. And I'm just really into Lincoln right now and like Civil War stuff in general. But Team of Rivals, it's fantastic. I was telling my sister, because she lent me a copy of it, and she was such a big fan of it. She's like, you have to read it. Please read it. Please read it. I told her, I was like, it's hard for me to believe that this book was as popular as it was because it's really dense. It's like 600 pages of like, really, like I'm halfway through. Abraham Lincoln has not yet gotten like the Republican nomination. And it's just very in the weeds of like, you know, all these different sort of power players and these different, you know, like how Lincoln really brilliantly kind of intentionally brought people who disagreed with him or who had been adversaries in the past onto his cabinet. It was really important to him to have people who didn't agree with him on his cabinet. That's cool. And Goodwin really exposes that a reason for that, like I just assumed everybody was on Lincoln's side in the North, right? And yet what I'm learning is, first of all, the Republican Party was brand new when he ran as a Republican, and he was having to negotiate bringing together the really radical Republicans who were super pro, you know, who were abolitionists, really hardcore abolitionists, who were like constantly disappointed by him for not doing enough about slavery, and more conservative Republicans and, you know, more liberal Democrats in the North. Just like anybody who is adept politically, it just blows my mind. I just can't imagine having that skill. So, but my favorite part of the book, I won't, everybody's read it because it's a million years old, but I will just really quickly say two favorite passages. One is that there was like an 11-year-old girl who, after Lincoln got the Republican nomination, wrote him a letter that said, you know, I really like you and you're so handsome, but your face is so thin. I really think you should grow some whiskers. And she said, plus the ladies love whiskers. And so he wrote back and he said something like, but don't you think that people would think it was a silly little affectation if I grew a beard now? But then he started growing his beard out. And so after he won and he was on his famous train ride from Springfield, Illinois to Washington, D.C. to like assume office, he met her and gave her a kiss on the cheek. And she said that she loved his whiskers. So
that's so sweet.
It was sweet. And then this. So Fanny Seward is the daughter of William Seward, who was the Secretary of State in Lincoln's cabinet. So she met Anthony Trollope, who is the famous British novelist. She met him at this dinner. And I just love this. Goodwin found this entry in her diary where she described him. She described him as a great, homely, red, stupid-faced Englishman with a disgusting beard of iron gray. I just really like stupid-faced Englishman.
Doo-doo head, stinky mouth. Pee-pee hands.
So that's it. I think I'm just going to have like I'm really late to the party review, and it'll be like books that everybody was reading like 15 years ago.
I love
it. I'll do like a Body Keeps the Score review in a while, yeah.
I should do the same with music, because I am like the kind of person that like if an album has gotten so popular, I like refuse to listen to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason. I'm just jealous. I'm just insane jealous. That's why.
And what's your next obsession, honey?
My next obsession is wedding planning.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one.
It's very exciting to be planning a wedding. And I at, you know, a couple weeks ago, I was like mass panicking. I was like, this is not, there's no way that I'm going to be able to do this. And now, I don't know, maybe I've gotten to the other side, but I'm really, really overconfident. I can feel it. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to start a planning business. Like, this is, I'm going to start doing this on the side. I love it.
When I realized how much everything cost, I was like, I am in the wrong business. Why did I not get into this? Like, what is wrong with me? Why did I decide that like being an English professor was going to be the way to go? But it's never too late. Catherine, yeah. How long have you and your wife been married?
We have been married for 8 years. We've been together, for almost 14. And we were engaged for like 3 years. So it took a long time for us to plan the wedding. And my wife is really private. And she kept saying, do they have to look at us while it's happening? And I was like, it's literally why they're here. They are witnessing. They're witnessing the promises we're making. She's like, but if we turn the chairs? And I was like...
Imagine what like an avant-garde art performance it would be if everybody was
right. I know. I was like, no, this isn't like performance art. We're getting married, honey. So it took us a long time, and we two were like really shocked. And in the end, we found like a really sweet little spot. Like accidentally, we had 50 people, and then awesome. She ended up having a great time and being like, "Oh, this is awesome." I was like, "Yeah, I know."
She's like, "I actually like being perceived."
Yeah, I know. And then we got married again 2 years later because it wasn't legal the first time, but we were tired of waiting. So we're just like, whatever, say what you want, but we're getting married. And then we got married the second time by the mayor of Ferndale, which is a little city by our house. And we got married on our anniversary, so we wouldn't have to remember two dates.
Oh, that's awesome. That makes me so happy.
The marriage, so nice. You did it twice. That's you can.
I
you
would
can
do it again. That. It's fun. Yes.
I'm trying to convince Wyatt that I need to be like, I need to get a cordless mic as I'm walking down and go, "Isn't she lovely?"
Definitely.
That's what I want. And I just want, all I want to be is perceived.
Yes. And I mean,
I get that.
And if you don't like perform the same sex marriage equality anthem at your own wedding, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I can rap the whole Macklemore's point. Part. I can. I'm going to change the lyrics, but I'll do it. Oh man. What about you, Catherine? Do you have another obsession?
I do. I'm really obsessed with virtual reality right now. Ooh. I really want to build the world of Nothing Much into VR so that you could like come to the village and hang out and like listen to a story in the coffee shop or like come into the yoga studio there and sit meditation with me. Oh. So it was totally a business expense for me to buy myself a new Oculus.
Yes. Oh my God. How is it? Is it as amazing
it's
as
super
I've heard?
Fun. It's super fun. And because I think because I'm someone with limited, like I have no imagination, I can conceptualize, but I can't imagine, right? It implies image. So there are experiences there that are so amazing. I use this meditation app where it's like you're sitting inside a kaleidoscope and you're watching all these colors. It's like whenever I was in a meditation where someone said, you know, imagine you're on the beach, I'd be like, I know what a beach is, but what do you like? I cannot like, do I this can't. Thing. I don't have access.
Yeah.
And then I do there. I like, there's like an exercise app called Supernatural where you like stand on top of a cliff and like box or like hit things with swords and it feels super fun. It's just fun. I just want to do it because it's fun.
Yes.
So that's a new obsession for me.
That's so cool. I mean, like the sky's the limit with how immersive the village of Nothing Much can be. Like, and also I would like to just say, I would like to put a down payment on a piece of property there, please.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Yes. I think it could be such a groovy place to go chill out, but it could also be, you know, like a positive distraction therapy. So like you're about to go in for surgery, you know, we've got a half an hour here. We were really going to calm you down, especially for little kids or people who like don't have as much access to the tools there to like calm their nervous system down. Like come into the village with me and we'll just like walk down the street together. So I really want to do that. That's
like when you had to get your blood drawn.
Yeah.
It would have been so nice for you to be able to escape into the village. Yes.
I get panicky whenever they take my blood from me.
But you had a really skillful bottomist.
They put it out of my body and I don't know, and I'll never get it back. So.
And maybe they're like, maybe it's a little witchcraft. That's what my dogs always say when they get their toenails clipped. They're like, they stole my toenails. It's probably witchcraft. I'm like, no.
Or it's going to end up somewhere in like crime scene and you're going to be framed. That'll be another great Nothing Much Happened story. It's about being framed for murder.
Yeah. Nothing Much Happens CSI.
We'll keep the world of true crime away from the village.
Yeah.
And my last obsession is, once again, late to the party club. We just watched that HBO show Hacks. Have you watched it, Catherine? Are you a TV?
No, I haven't watched it. Yeah, I love TV. Yeah.
So good.
It's about these, like this sort of older, like, I don't want to say like a washed up comedian, but like an older woman who's I think like glory days of being a comedian are sort of behind her, and she has like a Vegas residency, and she hires this other sort of like outcast from the comedy world, this comedy writer who's like this woman in her 20s who got canned from a different show.
She's a hot mess.
And they're just writing together as two sort of like wannabes slash has-beens slash washed up, like sort of just navigating this world together, and the generational differences and their ideas of like what's funny, and seeing them like workshop material together. And it's just such a cool, I had never really seen women comedians being, having their craft taken that seriously. And they kind of delve into like the experiences that speaking of the generational differences, like the sexual harassment and objectification that the older comedian like kind of just accepted as kind of part of the business. Like that's just what you had to do. Like you just had to put up with it in order to be successful. Yeah. And the perspective of this younger writer being like, holy shit, no, that's not okay. That's never been okay. That makes me incredibly uncomfortable. Just a really interesting dynamic. Yeah. And also Meg Stalter is in it. And she is like a comedian who got, I guess, kind of got popular during the pandemic. She would do these Instagram lives of just like comedy routines. Like there's one where she just pretended to be a trainer who is, doing corporate training for new employees at Walt Disney World. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my entire life. She's just so brilliant. So I'm just so glad that I've discovered her. She's so funny.
Yes. Awesome. I watched, she did a live recently. It was a live addressing a video that didn't get as many views as her other views or her other videos. This is like just like an absurd premise anyway. But it was, and she's inexplicably in like a head bandage with like clearly like nail polish on it or something. And there's just like, and it's never really addressed. And it's just absurd. And you were talk about like not sleeping. I have pretty bad insomnia sometimes. So you were asleep and I'm like watching this and I don't think I've ever, I had to turn it off because tears were just streaming down my face. I was laughing so hard, but I didn't want to wake you up. So I was like,
just shaking the bed very.
Yeah, right. There are just those people where it's like, there are some of those people where it's like, you were just put on this earth to be funny. And it's just this effortless, like, it's just like watching somebody perform magic in front of you. It's just so fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's you with your work. Like it's, when somebody finds what they are stellar at, and then appreciated for it, and then enabled to do it as work. You know, I felt that way with my art, where I was like, oh my God, I get to do this full time. Like, I don't have to bartend full time.
Yes.
Like, right. You know, like that was a really powerful moment to be like, not only am I accepted or like people enjoy my work, but they're like asking for it.
Right.
Like, oh my God.
Oh, I bet that's such an incredible feeling. Any other obsessions on the table, y'all?
No, that was it.
No.
Mine was Nick and Tamron Hall, which was
really, it's like we're stealing from each other.
It's
it's
like we're around each other all the time.
Almost. I like how we're the hand, where are these hand gestures? I started it. I don't even know why.
I think it's a Harry Potter thing.
Okay. I guess it's time for our poems.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, before we, since this is our last segment, Catherine, we just want to thank you, in case I forget when we're done, for being here. This was just such a pleasure. And yeah, it does feel like a full circle kind of moment. And I think seeing the kind of crosstalk that y'all have too is so interesting, because there's so many overlaps in y'all's kind of orientation toward art and the world. And
yeah, for sure.
It's so neat. I think so
too. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I really love talk. I feel like we could talk for a long time.
Oh,
yeah.
I think so too. And I think we'll be seeing you in Michigan, or you'll be seeing us in our.
I hope so.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yes. It's inevitable.
I have to say too, my favorite teacher of all time was from Flint.
Really?
Yeah. She was my fourth and fifth grade teacher, and she was amazing. She like sneaky taught us about feminism and like also like would point out in our social studies book, she's like, notice there's just a paragraph about enslaved people.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. then would like put the book down and like teach us, you know.
That's rad.
It was so cool. And I felt like it was also my first experience of watching somebody say, this is how things are done. Let me educate you about what really happened, you know?
Michiganders are just the best.
Yeah.
Like, honestly.
Oh, shucks. Yeah. I'm proud to be from Flint. I have to say, like, something about being from Flint, we never thought anyone was coming to help us. Mm. So we are scrappy in the best possible way. It's like, if you want a problem solved, okay, solve it. Like, if you want to create something, okay, you're going to be the one to do it, because there was always this feeling of nobody's coming. Right. So, you know, I think that made us like really good caregivers for each other. I think people from Flint really look out for each other and have each other's backs and are often resentful of the feeling of being portrayed, you know, sort of in living in this place where it's really difficult. And I don't want to downplay or romanticize the fact that it is difficult, but it also made me scrappy, and it made me inventive and just kind of be able to go, I'm just going to make it, because nobody else is going to.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. That really just so resonates with me. Yeah.
All right. Let's go with our poems. Do you want to go first? And did you, and you have a poem that you're going to read as well, Catherine?
I have a quote. I'm Googling. Good. While
Sorry. That was a weird reaction on my part.
That's okay.
Genuine. Okay, do you want to go first?
Okay, mine is mine's that Rachel Wiley poem. So I'm just like, just so you, like, is it where, you know, where yours at? Like, do you think it'll sit well?
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you for doing this.
We never do this.
I think mine should go first.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So what we're talking about, Catherine, is that very often, I don't know why I tend to pick poems that are a little bit dark, but I will decide to go last. And then it's like we leave on this note where it's like everybody is depressed. So we don't want to do that. And I don't think this is depressing, but it's a little bit darker. But this is, I think we might have read more from this poet than any other poet on this show, but it's Ada Limón.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a poem called Foaling Season. And it's a tad longer than what I usually read, but it's so worth it. It's so delicious. In the dew-saturated, foot-high blades of grass, we stand amongst a sea of foals, mare and foal, mare and foal. All over the soft hillside, there are twos, small duos ringing harmoniously in the cold, swallows diving in and out, their fabled forked tail where the story says the fireball hit as it flew to bring fire to humanity. Our friend the Irishman drives us in the gator to sit amongst them, everywhere doubles of horses still leaning on each other, still nuzzling and curious with each new image. Two female horses, retired mares, separated by sliding barn door, nose each other. Mm. Neither of them will get pregnant again. Their job is just to be a horse. Mm. Sometimes, though, they cling to one another, find a friend, and will whine all night for the friend to be released. Through the gate, the noses touch, and you can almost hear, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" I will never be a mother. That's all. That's the whole thought. I could say it returns to me watching the horses, which is true. But also I could say that it came to me as the swallows circled us over and over. Something about that myth of their tale, how generosity is punished by the gods. But isn't that going too far? I saw a mare with her foal and then many mares with many foals. And I thought, simply, I will never be a mother. The foal is a biter. And you must watch him as he bares his teeth and goes for the soft spot. He's brilliant, leggy, and comes right at me, as if directed by some greater gravity. And I stand firm and put my hand out first, rub the long white marking on his forehead, silence his need for biting with affection. I love his selfishness, our selfishness, the two of us testing each other, swallows all around us. Every now and then, His teeth come at me once again. He wants to teach me something, wants to get me where it hurts.
Jeez. Oh,
isn't that That's so beautiful?
Isn't that wow. so beautiful?
Yeah.
I'm so glad you loved it.
Oh, honey, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you liked.
I love that poem. She had such an opportunity to just stay. Yeah, it was a real clear choice to stay with I Will Never Be a Mother. And that, but she told the rest of the story. She told it. And like, it's just so I love that.
Oh, I'm so glad y'all liked it. I love it too.
Look, honey.
Oh my god, it's tiny.
This one's tiny. Okay, it's Itsy Bitsy.
I love little tiny.
Everything's making me cry. I love tiny.
Don't worry, Portia. I always love you the most. That's so that Portia can hear in the background.
So cute.
And Thank Catherine, you. We would love to hear your quote.
Yes, please.
Okay. I used to read a ton of Rumi because I feel like Rumi like lived down the street and just talked to you, right?
Yeah.
There was something like so natural and just like this feeling of like knowing a person and of being, so I would say this a lot to myself. It's just a line from a longer poem. He said, sit, be still and listen because you're drunk and we're at the edge of the roof. and I thought it was such a grounding moment because I'm someone who daydreams so deeply and lives so much in the stories I tell that I like very much to be reminded sometimes that you don't realize you're drunk and you're at the edge of the roof.
Yes!
So just be still.
I actually really love that. Yeah. And to like appreciate amongst the drunkenness on the roof, like to appreciate the quality of stillness, that it's important, that it keeps you safe. Yeah.
Yes. And that a friend might call you out. I would often say it when we would be like in a vinyasa class and I could see people sort of getting whipped up into the frenzy of their own energy and just kind of say like, before you throw that crazy handstand up, that might fall on three other people. You might be drunk on your own prana right now. And
I read this is
child's pose.
This only I haven't figured out how I want to work this into my daily conversations. It's just a nice little anecdote that apparently Abe Lincoln used to like to tell people. He said that in his hometown there was this bulldog that, you know, was just like a stray bulldog that wandered around the town. And he said, you know, people around the town would say that the bulldog didn't bite, not to be scared of it. And he said, so I'd say, I know the bulldog doesn't bite. You know the bulldog doesn't bite. But does the bulldog know that it doesn't bite? I love that. I haven't yet figured out. Maybe I'll just tell my students ominously and not tell them the point.
I love that.
Yeah, you like that idea? Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's a solid teacher move. I always feel like when I would present like a Zen story and then not explain it and be like, did I get it? Like, but did I get it? Okay.
You're like, sit with that. Sit with that. Sit your drunk ass down on the roof.
Yes.
And sit with that. Okay. Yes, honey, we'd love to hear
your poem. Just love, there's always like an ability. You can always sound profound if you just turn the phrase around.
Oh, yeah. You know? Like, that's not what the country can do. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Old rhetoric trick.
Okay, this is the this is my poem. This is from Rachel Wiley's new book, which is called Revenge Body, which I'm obsessed with is the title. And I had the pleasure of like reading her manuscript and providing a blurb for the book. I just love this poem got me. It did the thing. It is called White Feminism Watches the Color Purple. Mrs. Millie has always been kind to you people. Mrs. Millie said your children are so clean, it was a compliment. Say thank you to Mrs. Millie. Mrs. Millie said your children are so clean. Mrs. Millie forgave you your wild ways. Say thank you to Mrs. Millie. You really made it harder than it had to be. Mrs. Millie forgave you your wild ways. Did you hear that? Mrs. Millie is taking you to see your family. You made it blacker than it had to be. Don't you know who she is? Mrs. Millie has taken you to see your family. Mrs. Millie cannot get out of reverse. Don't you know who she is? Those men were trying to attack Mrs. Millie. Mrs. Millie cannot get out of reverse. How could you leave her alone with them? Those men were trying to attack Mrs. Millie. Mrs. Millie doesn't know your sister. How could you leave her alone with them after all she has done for you? Mrs. Millie doesn't know your sister. Be grateful, gal. After all we have done for you, it was a compliment. Be grateful, gal. Say thank you to Mrs. Millie.
Ooh, that's so good. I love how it sort of like picks up momentum. It like starts galloping mm-hmm. toward the end. Yes. It's really good.
Yeah. That felt like a novel.
Also, just yes. the idea of like you know, like, oh, like a white person like identifying with Mrs. Millie.
Right, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
And centering. Like it's all about Mrs. Millie.
Yeah. Yeah, right. For real. Oh my gosh. This was a wonderful conversation. I just love this. Thank you so much again, Catherine, for joining us.
It's really my pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you so much, y'all.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.